Jerry Pippin, and we'll be back with Jim Mars, our guest, here in just a second. But first, a reminder that on June 13th and 14th in Edinburgh, Texas, there will be the Border Zone 2 conference, and it will be broadcast from gavel to gavel, all the speakers here on jerrypippin.com as well as Inception Radio. And it basically is the entire conference, and it's free. So you can tune in June 13th and June 14th, and we'll also repeat each day. So if it works like the Border Zone broadcast from last year, it'll be nonstop conference speakers all weekend. Okay, let's get to Jim Mars again and discuss some things we've been talking about, plus some more details, new ideas. You brought up the New World Order, and you basically, Jim, are pointing out an amazing fact to me, and that is that everybody seems to be related. That's you sure. Gets into the seat of power.
That's right. And what is this small clique of people that seem to be, interestingly enough, from the royalty of Europe to the royalty of England, all the way to the pseudo royalty of the United States, mainly President of the United States and First Lady, and they're all related. And then let's look and see what they're really concerned with. And throughout history, going back to the pharaohs, the Caesars, the royalty of England, to even to the Hitler's Nazis, they were all concerned with the bloodline. Who's your daddy? You know, how are you related? So in other words, see, we may think that this concern over the bloodline and who you're related to, and does it track back to the ancient gods, we may think that that's just a bunch of claptrap, and we don't want to pay attention to it. But hey, they do. They believe in it. They know this stuff. And for them, it counts. Because if you're of the bloodline, then you get to move ahead. You get to be placed into positions of power, wealth, and authority. But if you're not, then, you know, you're left outside.
Now, in your book, Our Occulted History, you deal with the global cabal, I guess, in a way that the power is seated not necessarily just in like the United States or some other countries, but it's really more predicated on wealth and station in life.
Right. And who has the wealth? The banks. Who controls the government? The same people that control your life. If you own a mortgage, if you have a note on a car, if you've borrowed money to buy your clothes, your food, and your restaurant meals, you know, you're really not free because you're at the mercy of whoever you borrowed the money from. And chances are it's one of the banks. And so, you know, it's like one of the Rothschilds. The old Rothschild was quoted as saying, he says, "I care not who runs the country. I just want to know who controls the money, because whoever controls the money controls." It's the old golden rule. Whoever has the gold makes the rules. And and it's been that way.
The golden rule, literally. I mean,
literally.
Yeah.
And what's
gold.
Amazing is you go back and you find that with the arrival of these ancient astronauts, these ancient aliens, the Anunnaki, they began to set up kingship. They began to set up religions. They found religion was a good means of control. You tell everybody, you appoint your priest, your high priest, and he says, "I speak for God, and God told me to tell you, here's how you're supposed to live." And people bought into that for thousands of years, all the way certainly through the Middle Ages, when the universal or Catholic Church, the Roman Church, controlled everything in the Western civilization. And they had their own NSA. It was called the local priest. And you'd go to the local priest and you'd confess. And you'd tell him everything you knew. everything you suspected, and it was a tremendous intelligence surveillance system. And they used this, along with their money lending power, to gain control over the royalty, over the kings and the queens, which didn't dare do much of anything if they didn't have the permission of the Pope. And you can find this all through history. And it was only with the invention of the printing press and the Gutenberg printing press, and they began to print the Bible, which was, by the way, illegal for about 100 years. The first banned book was the Bible, because they didn't want people reading it for themselves and interpreting it for themselves. In fact, it was only in my lifetime, I was already a grown man, I think, before the Catholic Church finally allowed services to be conducted in English rather than in Latin, you know, which meant that when it was in Latin, only the people who could speak Latin, and that generally was the clergy, understood what was being said. And so then they would tell us what it all meant. But as the power of religion as a control mechanism began to wane, they turned to money changing, okay, finances. Again, golden rule. Whoever has the gold makes the rules. And are the two separate? No, they're not. You go all the way back, and we find out all the way back to the ancient temples in Sumer and in Egypt and in Greece, you know, the money, the tithing, the payment of the temple to the temple virgins, the payment to the temple priesthood. It's all part of the financial system. And in fact, when you get right down to it, Jesus, the Prince of Peace, when was the one time that he actually got violent with people? It's when he broke up the money changers. And where were they? In the bank? No, they were in the temple. So religion and money have been the two major control mechanisms. Today, religion is waning somewhat, although it's still pretty strong with a lot of people. But the money, the financial situation, is now the prime means of control. And in the United States, of course, that means the Federal Reserve System, which is neither federal nor does they have any reserves. In fact, it's a collection of private banks that are in turn owned by other private banks. In fact, a plurality of ownership in the banks that own and control the Federal Reserve are not even Americans. They're owned by foreign banks and foreign nationals. And yet the Fed is in charge of our money system. And in fact, it's interesting to note that in our history, there's only been two U.S. presidents to try to thwart this money control by the international banking cadre. The first being Abraham Lincoln, who, instead of borrowing money from the international bankers, as I'm sure they assumed he would, he instead printed his own money called greenbacks to finance the war between the states. The second president, interestingly enough, was President John F. Kennedy, who in June of 1963 issued $4.2 billion in currency, not through the interest-bearing Federal Reserve System, but through the Treasury Department. And he printed United States notes, and they weren't worth intrinsically anything any more than a Federal Reserve $5 note, but we didn't have to pay interest on it. And we all know that the bulk of the U.S. Budget every year goes to, quote, retire the national debt, which means pay interest on the money that we've borrowed to run the country. So these two presidents tried to put a stop to that and stop that slavery that is entailed by borrowing money at high interest rates that you'll never pay back, but is always compounded on the principal that you still owe, and you pay and pay on the interest, and you never can seem to quite get that principal down. So here's the two presidents trying to put a stop to that. And Jerry, I don't think it was just a coincidence that both Lincoln and Kennedy were shot in the head in public.
When you take all of the things laid out, they both were assassinated, and they both had crossed the Federal Reserve one way or the other. International Bank?
Exactly, yeah. In Lincoln's case, of course, there was no Federal Reserve, but it was still the coalition of international bankers that were
that's
funding.
The reason, yes, that's the reason
they were funding both sides of the war.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was trying
to put the international bankers because, that's this global economy, as far as the bankers are concerned, is not new.
It goes all the way back. That's what I'm saying. In fact, you can track it all the way back to the ancient astronauts. They figured out early on because, hey, picture this, we've got some of our astronauts and they are able to go to another inhabited planet and where the people are pretty primitive. They're still, living in caves and or little small dugout villages and they show up and say, here, we need to try some of our food. Here, you want a butter knife? Let me give you this knife. And, oh, by the way, look at this little handheld TV I've got here. See these pictures from on that and by. Listen, I've got to go. And they jump in their ship and they fly off. What are these primitives going to think? They're going to think, these are gods. These are gods. Because I believe it was Arthur C. Clarke who once said that any advanced technology would be seen as magic by people who are unaware of it.
Well, we've seen evidence of that even with Columbus landing here and the natives, they just, they couldn't explain it any other way than, it was something supernatural, something unlike anything they've known.
That's right. And I think it's still going on today. In fact, that may even bring us up to the missing Flight 370.
Right. I wanted to get to that and find out your
theories. When you have advanced technology, that's not known generally by the public, then you can come up with any cover story you want to, and nobody's in a position to adequately refute you. I see the same thing going on with 9/11, which, we're still in this period of time where we're not supposed to talk about that. But I guarantee you, Jerry, and you know as well as I do, that before too many years are out, there are already more and more people taking a serious second look at 9/11, and they are realizing that the official story does not hold up. For example, one of the things I'm talking about is you've got 210-story buildings, steel and glass, and they were all crumpled down, collapsed down on themselves from a fire, we are told. Well, according to experts who know what they're talking about, that should have left a debris pile of more than 10 stories. And yet, it was a debris pile of less than 2 stories. And I would submit to you, where are the toilets? That's one of the hardest things in the world to try to destroy if you're trying to get rid of an old toilet. What about the steel filing cabinets? Where were they? You don't find any of this. Whatever brought down the World Trade Center towers, it involved technology that the average person is simply not well aware of.
Yeah, I've been on the mend here for a while, recovering from cancer and a few other things. I keep getting new things happening to me that are not good in the medical field. They've been making a lot of progress, so I have lots of hope that I'll recover completely. And I don't know if I'm telling secrets out of school, but you were in intensive care there for a little while.
Yep. But, hey, I got over it, and I'm hoping you will, too.
Yeah, that's good. Now, the reason I mentioned that whole thing is because I am one of those that still is going to do a 9/11 show. Much like you've written some excellent books on the material around 9/11, and I plan on doing a really comprehensive series that nobody's even thought of doing, but my illness has pushed it back from last year, of course, to probably the fall, but we're going to take a series of stories. That's a complicated matter, and it may be simpler than I think once you get into it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
now
it's simple physics.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about this missing airplane. What What's going on there? How could they you know, you find they come find almost anything, and jet engines, they send out reports. I understand. I've talked to truckers and others who they say the company that they drive for knows if whenever something goes wrong with their diesel engine, as soon as the engine light, check engine light comes on, places calls to the mechanic and to the boss or executives, and that's the way they check them too to make sure they're on the route.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So what's happening there, do you think? You must have a theory by now.
Well, it was interesting to note that the aircraft's communication reporting system, that's the ACAR, ACARS, was switched off before this last radio message was sent. And that's according to the transport minister there in Malaysia. Well, you know, that indicates that somebody on board was actively short-circuiting or stopping the plane's reporting system. And, of course, the black box went off, and that's almost an impossibility. I have good friends who are pilots and commercial airliners today, and they say, you know, those things are built to withstand crashes, and yet there was no signal from the black box. And the only way that could be is if you somehow turn it off, and that would have to be done probably manually. So that indicates that there's something going on board. And now the latest news is that the authorities are looking very closely at the two pilots and even the flight engineer. In fact, there's one story that said the one of the pilots had actually been connected to some terrorist in the Middle East. So I think we need to keep ears and eyes and ears open to find out what's really going on.
Yeah, it looks to me like they finally admitted to change of direction and headed one of two places, and both of those places to the north. They've had long runways built since World War II, and so there's bound to be some around that they would take that plane and let it land and maybe take it off. The only thing is, how would they get more jet fuel? I'm just thinking maybe they might want to use it as a weapon later. And how could they control those that many passengers? But of course, we've seen
Let me tie this to 9/11, because being a award-winning aviation aerospace writer that got national award for my aerospace writing, I know a little bit about what I'm talking about. And on 9/11, it really boggled my mind that four separate teams of hijackers could hijack four separate airliners from different airports and on different schedules. And yet all their transponders went off at about the same time. How is that possible? And it actually is not, because you have to understand the crew's got, you know, the hijack team has to take over the airplane, then they have to go and locate the black box, and then they have to go and shut it off. And how is it possible that they could be doing all that at the same time from different airports and at different departure times? The answer seems to be that 9/11 involved the use of Global Hawk technology. And what's Global Hawk? Well, that's remote control of aircraft, what we now know as drones, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq. The very first aircraft that went into their airspace and ahead of the bombers and the fighters were these unmanned drones. And they were being piloted by computer operators at Fort Huachuca out in Arizona. And in fact, that's one of the concerns today, is that you have folks sitting at computer terminals in Arizona, and they're dropping bombs and shooting missiles from drones onto villages in Afghanistan. And I know over the past several months there's been a reported about 150 children killed, you know, and these things hit whole villages and knock out whole buildings. And it's all done wireless. It's all done by a computer. It's all done by remote control. Okay, so that would explain on 9/11 how all of the transponders went off at the same time through Global Hawk technology. But see, in 2001, most people were not aware of Global Hawk technology. If you try to tell them that you could capture the onboard computer of a commercial airliner, override it with a signal, and then capture the computer and then fly the airplane, regardless of what the flight crew or the passengers or even the hijackers want, they would go, oh, that's not possible. But it was. And we now know it because now you can even see ads when you go to the movies. There's ads for the Air Force and says, hey, come here, we'll train you how to fly these, you know, unmanned drones thousands of miles away. And so, yes, they had the technology. I knew about this at the time because in the late 80s, I had done an interview with an airline pilot, and at one point we were just kind of talking, and he said, you know, my job's redundant. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, the computer flies the aircraft. He said, I'm just there in case the computer breaks down. And so we got to talking further, and I found out that these computers took signals and broadcast signals. They're kind of like a GPS thing or your cell phone. They constantly send out signals, they're constantly receiving signals, and that's how they're able to determine their geophysical position and stay on their flight plan and everything. And that, therefore, it's entirely possible if you send a stronger signal, you can step on or override the normal signal, and you can capture that computer, and you can order that airplane to fly wherever you want to, land, or do whatever, crash, whatever you want it to do, and no one on board can do anything to stop it. In fact, in my book, The Terror Conspiracy Revisited, I quote the head of British Airways, who in early 2001 said, you know, hijacking is going to become a thing of the past because we now have the technology to capture the onboard computer and make the plane land safely, regardless of what the hijackers or even the flight crew want. So there you go. We know this now, but see, nobody seems to go back and apply it to 9/11, even though that technology was very much available at that time.
Yeah. In fact, this missing airplane
could have been the same thing. Mm-hmm. They could have captured the onboard computer, and they could have flown it anywhere, and that seems to be the case because some of the cell phone signals were still there, and some of the communications were still going on. Hours after it supposedly was lost at sea. And, of course, mm-hmm. they haven't found any debris, which indicates that it may have been captured by Global Hawk technology and then sent somewhere else to land. But it's going to be very surprising if at some point something doesn't turn up, because even if it was hijacked, they got to take it somewhere, and they wouldn't have... If they hijacked it, it's only for one or two purposes. Either they want to have some kind of demand, you know, release these terrorists, or we'll blow this up with all these people, or it's to gain a potential weapon, pack it full of explosives, and then fly it into something just like they did on 9/11. But in either of those cases, then eventually there should be some word of this plane. And the fact that there is still none is pretty fascinating and kind of scary.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, you're talking about all of this. Immediately I think of military applications and war.
Oh, of course. Well,
then, they may be able to... take over airplanes. They can take over ours because you got the. I don't know if they can get into the say the foreign country, the invader, but they probably figured out a way to do that.
Right. Well, you know, let's face it. There's nothing technology-wise that one man can invent that another man can't figure out a way to get around it or destroy it or whatever.
That's right. Let's talk a little bit more about the book, because we were last talking about the banks,
mm-hmm.
and the connection. Let's go back to biblical times, for instance. There were money at centers. I guess I don't know if they called them banks or not, but
no, they were temples.
Yeah,
but within the temples was money lending, money changing, money exchanging. You know, all kinds of stuff going, all kinds of economic activity going on.
Yeah, and so that story, I've always wondered about Jesus when he, you know, caused havoc there with the money changers in the temple. I always thought that, you know, there was probably more than one temple in charge. Maybe that particular temple was our answer to today, the Fed. Who knows?
Could have been the central, instead of the central bank, it was the central temple.
Yeah.
That's entirely possible.
Okay,
entirely
now.
Entirely possible. And of course, you know, there's a. I'm reminded, I saw a picture, a painting of Jesus, you know, throwing out the money changers. And the caption said, "Even Jesus can take only so much." And its headline, Jerry, with the word usury. Okay, now I know that you know what usury means, but think about it. How many people under the age of 50 even know what usury is?
No, I don't think they do.
Well, folks, usury simply means charging interest on a loan. And it used to be considered sinful. In fact, in the Texas Constitution, in my lifetime, back when I started in journalism in the 60s, if you charged over 3% interest, you were in violation of the state constitution, and you were charged with usury. Well, what happened was the banks began to grow more and more powerful, and they managed to buy off more and more legislators. So they kept getting them to change this, and it went from 3%, then went to 6%, then went to 8%, pretty soon 9%, then 10%, 12%. And by this time, as the interest rates continue to go up, and some of you probably are well aware that you're paying upwards to 25, 29% interest on some of your bank cards, you know, they finally just did away with that whole provision in the state constitution. And today, most people don't even understand what usury is. They just think that's the way things are. You go borrow money from a bank and they charge you interest. But that's not the way it's always been. In fact, it used to be considered not only against the law, but a sin to charge
interest. Yeah, it was sinful, no doubt about it. Our time's up, Jim. Give the name of the book again.
Our Occulted History.
And you like this subject all along, because we've talked about it off and on as our paths cross over the years.
Well, you know, I've always wanted to know who's truly in charge. I mean, it's obvious Obama can't get his health care plan through, so he's not in charge. Bush, you know, there's no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, so obviously he's misinformed, ill-informed. He's not in charge. So who's in charge? Who's really trying to run the show? And where they come from, and what gives them a right to tell us how to live? That's my questions, and that's what I try to answer in Our Occulted History.
Okay, it's available now, folks, at a bookstore near you. Right, Jim?
That's correct, or off my website, jimmarrs.com. That's JIMMARRS.com, or at any of your favorite bookstores, and, of course, Amazon.
Okay.
Thank you, Jerry.
I've always enjoyed having you on. We'll do it again sometime.
Okay, take care.
Okay.
Bye.